Next, we're going to hear from Carolyn Runge. Did I pronounce that right? Okay. I checked with her before, and I think it stuck with me. She is going to talk, bring us down to more the local and the regional level of groundwater management in the state. Caroline is a native of Presidio County. She grew up in Valentine, Texas, which you don't meet many people that grew up in Valentine, Texas. That's great. She's practiced law in Mississippi and New Mexico, attended the Water Resource Administration Program at the University of New Mexico. She's been back in Texas since 1996. She manages the Menard County Underground Water Conservation District out west. She also is a consulting manager to the Hickory Underground Water Conservation District. She serves as an environmental representative for the Region F Regional Water Planning Group. And she's also secretary of the Groundwater Management Area 7, which is out in the Edwards Plateau area. So we're really excited to have Caroline and her expertise here to give us her perspective on what's going on at the local level.
I'm very aware that the last speaker before lunch is under intensive time pressure, so I will try to fast forward through this. So far this morning, you've had springs and spring protection sort of written large. I'm now going to take you down to the ground level, you know, where the springs are. And in thinking about how I was going to approach this, I thought I better just stick with what I know best, which is what a small and relatively impoverished groundwater conservation district does to protect springs in a very large spring-rich aquifer. It's kind of the nuts and bolts of what we do down there to take care of your springs, and this talk should probably really be titled the Groundwater Conservation District User's Manual for Spring Flow Protection in a Low-Yield Zone of the Limestone Karst Aquifer. Now, that sounds like a pretty narrow niche, but that's actually what springs are. They're fairly localized operations of the grounds of the laws of hydrology. And the most important premise to grasp in thinking about various methodologies for protecting spring flows in Texas is that there are 9 major aquifers in Texas and 21 minor aquifers designated by the Water Development Board and counting. They add more all the time. The hydrogeological characteristics and production yields vary tremendously among those aquifers, as do the concentrations of economic activity and the population. So there's no one surefire template for protecting spring flows. And I have groundwater district colleagues out here in the audience that will tell you that what we do for groundwater protection in our district will not fly in their district, so you can go talk to them and see what they do. Sometimes even within an aquifer, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, you will have zones that need to be treated differently from other zones in the same aquifer. Of course, springs are impacted generally by what's going on in the aquifer, and the one common rule is that to maintain spring flows, you have to maintain certain water levels at a certain depth. Now, the tricky part is figuring out how deep those water levels can go without impairing the spring and where those water levels need to be protected. So, you know, in terms of trying to come up with a plan, you have to amass a good deal of hydrogeological knowledge. You have to apply the permitting tools that are particularly applicable, that are available to you under Chapter 36 of the Texas Water Code, and there's a wide range of those. And probably most important is you have to have an aptitude for creativity in resolving the conflicts among the 3 big hydrologies, which I will get to in a minute. We probably bear a particularly heavy burden of responsibility for spring flow protection in GMA 7, which is the, you saw the map that Ted put up. It's the designated groundwater management area for the Edwards Trinity Aquifer. And in his epic work that you've been hearing about all morning on Texas Springs, Gunnar Brun points out that all of Texas' largest springs discharge from the Edwards Formation and the associated limestones. The real biggies are Comal Springs and San Marcos Springs in the Edward Aquifer, and they're in that Region 8, I think it is, that is the Edwards Aquifer GMA. But 11 of the 17 that are on Brun's list as the largest springs in Texas are in GMA 7, widely spaced. One of those 11 is in my district, and another one is right on the district line to the west. And both of those are major contributing springs to the San Saba River, which provides 90% of all the supplies, 90% of all the water use in our district. And I want to point out that the Edwards Trinity Plateau, which is that big area in GMA 7, is not the same as the Edwards Balcones Fault Zone aquifer, which is the one you have down here that supplies so much of the water for San Antonio. There is a commonality of formation there, and there is some hydrological connection, but there's a huge difference in the amounts and volumes of water that you have in the two areas, which leads all of us up where we live to the dark suspicion that all of our water is just flowing through and puddling up down here on the Balcones Escarpment for people down here to use, that we could use up there. Of course, even more sobering for groundwater districts is the in our GMA is the awareness that so many of our springs are already gone. Ted told you about Comanche Springs. That was in GMA 7. And Goodenough Springs, which is buried under Lake Amistad, is also in GMA 7. So we know we're up against some time constraints also in trying to develop our plans. I consider that there are really three important considerations in managing for maintenance of spring flow. And I find it useful to kind of think of them all as forms of hydrology. The usual definition of hydrology is the scientific study of the properties, distribution, and effects of water on the Earth's surface, in the soil and underlying rocks, and in the atmosphere. So the most important management tool for a district is to assemble a body of knowledge about the hydrogeology of the aquifer and to correctly interpret the data that you've assembled, which is another difficult task sometimes. And that includes the recharge characteristics, the production zones, the yields, any place where you have compartmentalization or block faulting. I do work for the Hickory District, too, and it's interesting because the faulting in the Hickory District is so great that sometimes in a space of just a few feet, you will find one zone of the Hickory formation hundreds of feet above the adjoining zone. And so basically there's no GAM for the Hickory District right now, and we are trying to work out the DFCs and how we're going to come up with the managed available groundwater. So we're working very closely with the Water Development Board in trying to come up with those. But dividing it into zones is going to be one of our big problems because there's so much difference from one zone to another and no hydrogeological connection from one to the other. Then we also have to take into account what I term economic hydrology, which is the semi-scientific study of the effect of surface economic activity on the allocation and distribution of groundwater. And then finally, lately we've had an awful lot of political hydrology, which is the totally unscientific but powerful effect of the activity of the legislature and political subdivisions on the allocation and distribution of groundwater. All three inevitably play a significant role in spring protection, both at the local level and then have to be looked at again when we get into the GMA planning, and you've got all those other districts you've got to deal with too. Gunnar Brun stated that only where there's sufficient information to link specific aquifers and recharge zones to particular springs, and where there's some regulatory mechanism, such as a groundwater conservation district or an aquifer authority like the Edwards Aquifer Authority, can any real efforts be made at spring flow. Now, currently in Texas, about 89% of all of the water that's produced, of all the groundwater that's produced, is in a groundwater conservation district. You know, as new groundwater supplies open up, that may not be true. But up there in that far northeastern corner, where you don't see very many groundwater conservation districts, they don't use much groundwater. They rely much more on surface water supplies. And I want to digress here a moment and just touch on an issue that we hear a lot about among groundwater conservation districts, and that's the whole issue of aquifer-wide management or consolidation of districts within an aquifer. And to our way of thinking, this whole new joint planning process that we have in the GMAs is a much better mode of effectively managing groundwater, especially for spring protection, than consolidating districts or having an aquifer-wide authority. And there's several reasons why we feel that way. For one thing, to protect springs, we'll have to assemble a lot of very localized data. A state agency or an aquifer-wide authority that's overseen by the state won't have the money or the personnel to do that. The Edwards Aquifer can do it because, A, it has a location and an abundance of water supply, which make it important to a very large population, which can provide the funding, and B, it encompasses a relatively small area. The Edwards GMA is one-tenth the size of the Edwards Trinity GMA and has way under more water in it. The Edwards Trinity GMA covers about 13% of the state, more than 32,000 square miles, and has less than 3% of the population. There are 21 groundwater conservation districts in GMA 7. People say, well, why don't you all get together? Well, we have very different issues. You know, over on the eastern end of the aquifer where I live, we have several districts that our primary concern is preserving spring flows and stream flows in our rivers. We rely very heavily on surface water, even though, ironically, we get more rain than the western side of the aquifer, which has much more abundant supplies of water, and they do a lot of irrigation over there. And then in between, there's between the far western, where they are concerned with regulating irrigation, and the far eastern, where we're trying to take care of stream flows, there's an area that's primarily concerned with water quality issues. They're not concerned with quantity issues. But at, you know, most of these GMA, these groundwater conservation districts have staff of 1 to 3 people. The majority of them in our GMA working at pay levels below state pay levels with no medical benefits, no retirement benefits. And we go out and we measure monitor wells, measure surface water flows, maintain well level and rainfall records, do water quality tests, and if funds are available, we hire hydrogeologists to help us make sense of it all. What you really need to do is think of it as kind of the Texas Rangers of water. You know, if you remember how it went in the War of Independence in Texas, you showed up to fight against overwhelming odds, and you had to bring your own gun, your own horse, and your own uniform. And so that's kind of what we do. But we have, you know, we have access to a lot of local knowledge that isn't available to outsiders. and we care about our communities, and we've assembled an enormous amount of local information, which is particularly important in protecting spring flows. It's also been my observation that the general tendency is for districts to be single or multi-county in a way that's correlated with the type of aquifer. The multi-county districts are tending to form in areas where there's an aquifer with a fairly uniform distribution of water and large volumes of it. And the single-county districts tend to form where the water is randomly distributed, and the yields are low or very widely, and the agricultural base is either mostly livestock or a mix of crop of livestock, or agriculture isn't the main user of water. In the latter type of aquifer, there's much more need for flexibility to effectively manage the aquifer, and we think that the single-county style of evolution of groundwater districts has evolved for good reasons in those areas, particularly in the Edwards Trinity Aquifer, and that this is one more place where maybe it's not a good idea to fool with Mother Nature. The primary management goal of the Menard County Underground Water District is the protection of spring discharges, which, as I said, produce the surface water supply for 90% of all the use in the county. And our management plans and goals are all set around that objective. Now, let me set the scene a little bit for our aquifer so you can understand why we manage the way we do, which will be very different from the way another district does it. We are a very groundwater poor county. It's very interesting that two of the springs in our county are listed on Gunnerbrunn's list of largest springs in Texas. But generally speaking, our average well in Menard County will only yield about 5 gallons a minute. It's only enough for domestic and livestock production and won't supply anything more than that. And we have one area in the very western part of the county that has much larger production, and those are in the path of inflow into the government springs at McCabot, which you saw a picture of earlier today. And just as a by the way, General Phil Sheridan of Civil War fame said that Fort McCabot was the prettiest fort in all of Texas. So. And, of course, one of the reasons it was built there was because of the spring. And there was it wasn't just that the military needed the supply of water, but those springs that go all across the Edwards Trinity Aquifer were extremely important to the development of commercial trade in Texas. And all of those forts that you heard mentioned earlier this morning were built not only because on springs, not only because they were using the water from the springs, but they were fighting the Comanches and the Apaches off those springs so that there could be trade. The three major roads from San Antonio to Santa Fe and to Chihuahua all developed along those springs, and our history is littered with the bodies of dead horses and mules, and occasionally military people or freighters who, Ted and I were talking last night about, you know, the biggest challenge was making it to the spring in Fort Stockton, Comanche Springs. There are a number of springs that you could leap off from there and make that, but that was the hardest gap to make, because once you got to there, then you could go on to the springs at Balmoray or the springs at Fort Davis, and your path is fairly, fairly clear from then on. And then we also have the Clear Creek Springs, or what's now called Clear Creek Springs in Bruins' book. They're called Wilkinson Springs, and that forms the headwaters of the biggest tributary into the San Saba River. And back 250 years ago, the Spanish government decided, because of the abundance of water right there below where Clear Creek and Los Moros Creek and Celery Creek come into the San Saba River, that they were going to establish the northernmost permanent outpost of the Spanish government in what was, you know, pre-Texas in 1756. So in 1756, they arrived and they began digging a 10-mile-long irrigation canal, which exists and is used to this day in Menard County. And it goes from about 4 or 5 miles up above the city to, our city's got 1,700 people, so city. It goes from about 4.5 miles above the city right through the middle of town, right across the courthouse lawn, and empties back into the river about 5 miles below. Now, this isn't your soulless concrete-lined irrigation canal. This is a canal that winds around through the woods and along the bluffs and meanders through town. But it's been invaluable to us in gaining information on the hydrogeology of our aquifer, which is very different from the western part of the county to the eastern part of the county. Several years ago, with a lot of help from the LCRA, which we really appreciated, our district put in gauges all along this irrigation canal. And we learned that seepage and evaporation from the canal, this is just a dirt canal. In some parts, it's got rocks lining the sides of the wall to keep it from caving in. But the seepage and evaporation rate from the canal down to Menard is about 15%. It's 50% from Menard on east. And there's very different topography. I mean, it's rocky, hilly. I'm going through all this to explain how difficult it is to actually target your regulation to protect the springs. And so, you know, after Menard, it widens out into a wide alluvial plain where most of the irrigation goes on, but it's very porous, and the waters from the ditch flow out into that formation. And if it dries up, we lose a lot of water just refilling that formation. A couple of years ago, we had a breakage in the ditch. We had to close it down, and the when we turned the ditch back in, it took 2 days to go to the halfway point, which is the gauge in Menard, and it took over a month to go the other half of the distance because it was recharging all of those spaces back. And so one thing that we've learned is, and the all of the important springs are in the western side of the county. So what we do know, we have to develop more information before we can regulate that in that sophisticated a matter, but we do know that basically nothing we do in the western part of the county is going to do any good. Those springs are ephemeral down there. They dry up just during drought. They dry up when the mesquites come out. You know, I watch the gauges every year, and as soon as they start leafing out, which is right about now, we see big depletions in the water levels. So we've been able to localize the area that we have to protect. We maintain several monitor wells around the district, and some of them to get general ideas about the levels in the district, and others to particularly monitor the underflows of the river, which give us an idea about what the springs are doing. We also record rainfall levels at many of the same locations that we have monitor wells, so that we can get an idea about recharge. And that also varies widely over the district. We have some wells that recharge a matter of feet when we have a rainfall, and others will stay within 2 inches regardless of rain or drought or anything else. We our rules are really very draconian. They're probably some of the toughest ones in the state. But we've put a lot of effort into informing our citizens about why we're doing this, and we've received overwhelming public support for passage of those rules. Because the residents, I mean, everybody in Menard County is well aware of how very important that water in the San Saba River is to the economy of the district. We don't permit any new irrigation wells in the Edwards Trinity Aquifer. All we allow is domestic and livestock wells. We have some new irrigation wells in the Hickory Aquifer in the eastern part of the county, but for most of the county, it doesn't matter because they can't produce enough water to meet the exempt amounts anyway. But in those very few areas where there could be more pumpage, that would affect the spring flows. It's a backup because since we have such low flows and we don't permit anyway, we do have a built into our rules a cap on total production from permitted wells in the county, which is set at our current estimated recharge amount. We think maybe recharge is a little overestimated for the county, but as we learn more about that, we'll adjust our rules downward to meet that cap. Another big problem we have is with the sale and subdivision of a lot of our ranches, which is happening a lot, especially along the river. And that causes us concern because it has resulted in a dramatic increase in the number of domestic and livestock wells, so much so that we're worried about areas that are sensitive. Consequently, during the 2005 legislative session, we were able to get legislation which allows us to require a permit for wells within certain brackets on less than 100 acres. And I think we're the only district in the state that can regulate wells. It's just for the Edwards Trinity wells. You know, we don't have this bracketing on the Hickory wells, but we can cut down the amount of exempt well drilling in those particular areas. And this is where we experience the interface of economic and political hydrology with scientific hydrology. In spite of the evidence that these areas need to be protected, we couldn't have gotten these rules in place if we didn't have a very sparsely populated county and if these subdivisions weren't largely populated by non-residents who don't live there all year round and don't generate any income in the county. And, you know, it's very apparent that drilling more and more of these domestic and livestock wells will impair the agricultural production. And so we've gotten a lot of support for these rules. The good thing is that as more and more people move into the county, these rules are already in place and they're already traditional. And so it just shows that it pays to shut the stable door before the horse even knows that it's open. Now, this brings up one of the fundamental principles of groundwater district management, which is it's always easier not to let a landowner have something in the first place than it is to take it away from him later. So we feel very strongly, set our rules at these very strict levels, and then if, as, and when we discover we have more water, we can loosen them up. But I worked with some other water districts where they were trying to go the other way, and that is really difficult. Years ago, when I was working up in New Mexico, I learned an early lesson, which I was glad to have, about erring on the side of caution in developing your rules and allowing production. I was present at a meeting where the USGS metaphorically kind of hung its head and confessed that the study they had done 25 years before had way overstated the amount of recoverable storage in the aquifer that underlies Albuquerque. And in fact, there was only about one-tenth as much recoverable storage in the aquifer, Well, Albuquerque had marched right ahead making all of its plans based on, you know, these 3 billion acre feet, and now they were up against the wall because there was not nearly that much available. And since then, they've been scrambling to try and tap into the resources. So the other fundamental principle is never stop gathering and assessing your hydrological your information pertaining to your area of concern. Keep on studying, because there's more and better information there all the time. Now we get down to what we do in the groundwater management area. I appreciate very much Ted setting that up for me, so you know what the DFCs are and what the process is. Now there was a voluntary joint planning provision or process in Chapter 3. I'm sorry. Okay. Oh, what a good thing. I'm always glad to be drowned out by rain. A voluntary process existed in Chapter 36 before the legislature passed the mandatory process in 2005. And so our districts in Texas, now am I too close? Our districts in West Texas that were in Region F at the time, we started this process before the groundwater management areas were designated. But we all met, you know, since we're mostly single county districts, we all met on a regular basis several times a year and worked on resolving common problems and sharing information. And we started that process in 1988. And when the regional water planning process was established by Senate Bill 1 in 1997, we just went right ahead with that. And in the first regional water plan for our region, the 16 districts, got together, we divided up the aquifer into zones and assigned different depletion levels to those zones. Now, there were several questions asked earlier about getting specific spring flows into the GMA planning process. And since the GMA planning process started, there were several districts in our area that wanted to do that. We wanted to set minimal spring flow levels. Well, when we went to talk to the Water Development Board about that, they said, you can't do it that way because the resolution of the GAM is, unless you have a spring in a spell that was used to calibrate the GAM, you can't do it that way, but you can do it, as Ted said, by setting the levels, your aquifer levels. And so even then, back in 2000 and, you know, 99 and 2000, when we were working on it, we had this concept of depletion levels in our mind. And so we had one zone in the aquifer with with depletion limited to recharge, that we weren't going to exceed recharge. And then there were two other zones that had a lot of irrigation that went with, I think, 50% over 50 years and 50% over 100 years. Well, we've just refined that process now. We've added in 5 new districts that came in with the establishment of GMA 7. And that's gone pretty smoothly because 16 of us were already used to working together, and we have now gone and redivided the area into zones. We have found that on the west, western edge of the aquifer, where there's so much irrigation, they want to have a certain amount of depletion, but we have discovered with monitor wells and everything that there doesn't seem to be much impact of irrigation in those areas on the more sensitive areas to the east. And while we originally wanted to go with 3 zones, one specifically targeting maintaining certain stream flows, we found that that's impractical, and so now we have two zones, one which is a no net depletion over 50 years. We realize that sometimes during periods of drought, well, in drought in our area, wells dry up just because there's drought and not because anybody's doing anything. And so, you know, the idea is to maintain a goal of having the normal level be the same 50 years from now as it is at present. And then in the irrigation districts, which are along the north and eastern, north and western side of the aquifer, they're going with a 50% depletion over 50 years. So at the moment we have, and this is a good process to go through too, we have requested from the Water Development Board a baseline dam run, which takes our present pumpage in each district and projects it over 50 years to see what our depletion levels look like if we keep on pumping at the same level that we do now. And once we've gotten that information, then we can proceed with, refining that process to arrive at our desired future condition. Now, I do want to make clear, in case it wasn't clear from what Ted said, that the district's input into this is arriving at the desired future condition. Once that happens, then those desired future conditions are submitted to the Water Development Board, and they run the GAMS, and they tell you what your managed available groundwater is. So, you know, it behooves groundwater districts to work closely with the board all through this process. And finally, I know I'm out of time. I'm sorry. But the last thing I want to say is that it's really important for groundwater districts. You know, it's such a tendency. We all love groundwater. We want to go out and we want to measure levels and we want to measure stream flows and we want to do all that kind of thing. But it's really important for groundwater districts to get out and educate and participate. Get those kids when they're young. Build that conservation mentality into them right now because they are going to need it. And, you know, I think it's important to get a conservation mentality going in kids as much as it is anti-smoking or anti-drugs or whatever it is. So we give programs in the school. We write newspaper articles, educational newspaper articles in the district. We participate in 4-H field days with conservation projects. We have, in Menard County, we have a terrific extension agent who's very much into rainwater harvesting. So our elementary school has a rainwater harvesting project, which waters native plants for the kids to look at. Our junior livestock barn has a rainwater harvesting facility, and our brand new community center has a rainwater harvesting facility. Participate. When we were having discussions, the Soil and Water Conservation District was trying to prioritize where the EQIP funds were going to go. The Water District jumped in and persuaded them to give priority to brush control projects in the watershed of the San Saba River so we could improve flows, and we were successful in doing that. So hang in there. Keep working.
Thanks to both of our speakers. Carolyn is a really good example of a groundwater district that's doing a really good job as far as spring flow protection, groundwater management. I encourage everybody, both landowners and people that are concerned about the groundwater in their area, to contact their local groundwater conservation district, see what their priorities are, and start to build those relationships if you don't have them already, because that's really important that there is that interaction with landowners in each of the districts so that that they can help represent you at the different levels of water policy and water management. We have a couple quick things. Is we have a number of resources that are available out this way. One of them is the Parks and Wildlife had an amazing film that they released a few weeks ago on the state of Texas Springs. We have copies of those DVDs. We have about 150, which isn't enough for everyone. I apologize. This is a great turnout. But if you're interested in one of those and haven't seen it, go ahead and take one. If you want another one, or if you want one and you don't get one, let us know, and we'll try to see if we can hook you up with them. We are going to play it on on one of the TVs in the workshop area. And the other thing, too, we have a couple great landowner resources. There's Streamside Management in the Hill Country. Another one is Cedar Biology and Management. These are done by the Cibolo Nature Center, the Texas chapter of the Nature Conservancy. We had a number of copies. We don't have that many left, but these are listed on your landowner resources guide, which is in your folder. We also have Helen Bessie's out there. She's got the Volume 1 of Gunnar Bruins. She has information about Volume 2. She's also working on a spring owner's guide that you can sign up for to get information about that when it's available.